Don't let anyone walk away without signing up. And your perp, he jabbed at the screen, was no exception. We've got a name. And an address. Dylan presented the information with the flourish of a magician confident of applause. So, who is it? Murray leaned forward to read the screen. Dylan got there first. Anna Johnson. He must have misheard. Anna Johnson. Murray read the details for himself. Anna Johnson, Oakview, Cleveland Avenue, Eastbourne. Is that our murderer, then? Murray opened his mouth, about to say that no, that wasn't their man, that was the victim's daughter. But, however helpful Dylan had been, he was still a member of the public, and as such, would need to be kept in the dark a little longer. Could you print this off for me? You've been very helpful. He made a mental note to write to Dylan's boss when all this was over. Perhaps they'd send him something other than a Samsung Galaxy S8. The printout seemed to burn in his pocket as he made his way, faster this time, through the shopping center and out towards the lanes. Anna Johnson. Anna Johnson bought the phone used to make the witness call confirming her father's suicide. Murray was getting more and more confused. Nothing about this case added up. Had Tom Johnson borrowed his daughter's phone for some reason? Sean's digging had confirmed that the fake witness call purporting to be from Diane Brent Taylor was the first time the handset had been used. Was it credible that Anna had bought the phone for an innocent reason and that Tom had taken it that same day, hours before his death? Murray walked back to his car, oblivious to the crowds now. If Tom Johnson didn't go to Beachy Head to commit suicide, why did he go there? To meet someone? Someone who was secretly planning to kill him? Murray played out scenarios in his head as he drove home. A clandestine affair uncovered by a jealous husband. A struggle that resulted in Tom going over the cliff edge. Had the killer used the phone Tom had borrowed from his daughter to make false calls to the police? The lover? Why choose Diane Brent Taylor as an alias? Murray shook his head impatiently. The killer wouldn't have had a spare SIM card unless Tom's murder was premeditated. And, if it was premeditated, the murderer would have acquired their own burner phone, not happened upon a spare one in his victim's pocket. None of it made sense. It was all so... Murray struggled to pinpoint the word. Staged. That was it. It didn't feel real. If he took the witness call out of the equation, what did he have? A missing person. A suicidal text from Tom's phone, which anyone could have written. Hardly evidence of murder. Hardly evidence of suicide. And Caroline's death. Was that any more substantial? Everything pointed towards suicide, but no one had seen her. The chaplain, poor man, had guided her back to safety. Who was to say she hadn't stayed there? A dog walker had found her bag and phone on the cliff edge, conveniently in the spot where the chaplain had found a distressed Caroline. Circumstantial evidence, sure, but hardly conclusive. And, like her husband's disappearance, somehow too staged. Real deaths were messy. There were loose ends, pieces that didn't fit. The Johnson suicides were far too tidy. By the time Murray pulled up on his driveway, he was certain. There was no witness to Tom's death. There was no murder. There were no suicides. Tom and Caroline Johnson were still alive. And Anna Johnson knew it. Chapter 44. Anna. It is strange to see Mum back in Oakview. Strange and wonderful. She's nervous, but whether it's due to fear of detection by Mark or by Dad, I couldn't say. Either way, she jumps at the slightest sound from outside and offers little contribution to the conversation unless asked directly. Rita shadows her wherever she goes, and I wonder how she will be affected when Mum leaves again. because that's the deal. 3 more days as a family, albeit a family filled with secrets, and then it's over. You don't have to go. We're in the garden, my words turning to mist as they leave my mouth. It's dry today, but so cold it hurts my face. Ella is in her bouncy chair in the kitchen, facing the window so I can keep an eye on her. I do. Mum begged to come out into her beloved garden. It's overlooked only on one side, the high hedges on the other two sides protecting us from curious glances. But even so, my heart is in my mouth. Mum's tackling her roses, not the expert pruning that we'll need doing in spring, but cutting them by a third so the winter winds don't snap the stems. I have neglected the garden, Mum's pride and joy, and the roses are leggy and unbalanced. Someone will see me if I stay. It's too big a risk. She glances continually at Robert's house, the only place from which we can be seen, despite the fact we saw him drive away this morning, loaded with late Christmas presents for relatives up north. Mum is wearing Mark's gardening coat, a woolly hat pulled low over her ears. You should have cut these buddleias back last month, and the bay tree needs fleecing. She shakes her head at the fence between our garden and Robert's, at the climbing roses and the sprawl of clematis I should have cut back after it flowered. It's looking better already, although I hear Mum tut from time to time, and suspect my lack of attention has left some plants too far gone to save. There's a book in the kitchen. It tells you what needs doing every month. I'll look at it, I promise. A lump forms in my throat. She's serious about leaving, about not coming back. I read somewhere that the first year of loss is the hardest, the first Christmas, the first anniversary, a full set of seasons to endure alone, before a new year brings fresh hope. It's true, it was hard. I wanted to tell my parents about Ella, to share pregnancy stories with my mother, and send Mark and my dad to the pub to wet the baby's head. I wanted to cry for no reason, while Mum folded tiny baby grows and told me everyone got the baby blues. The first year was hard, but I know there are harder times ahead. The finality of death is unarguable, but my parents are not dead. How will I come to terms with that? My mother will leave me of her own free will, because she is too scared to be here where my father will find her. Too scared to be where she may be recognized, and her crimes exposed. I will no longer be an orphan, yet I will still be without parents, and the grief that I feel is every bit as raw as if I were truly bereaved. Robert's paying for the garden to be landscaped, once his building work has been done. Will the plants against the fence survive being moved? Too late. I realize I shouldn't have mentioned the extension. Have you lodged an objection? You must. It'll make the kitchen incredibly dark, and you'll have no privacy on the patio. She begins to list the reasons why Robert's extension is a travesty, her voice an octave higher than it was. And I want to ask why she cares when she has made it clear she won't come back here again. But then I think of the way she is carefully tending roses she won't see bloom. We are programmed to care long after we need to. I make vaguely supportive noises, and don't mention the money Mark negotiated in compensation for the inconvenience of building works. Help me move this. Mum has finished fleecing the bay tree. It stands in a vast terracotta pot on top of a manhole cover. It needs to be somewhere more sheltered. She tugs at the pot, but it doesn't even shift an inch. I walk over to help her. Robert's builders will move it when they dig up the sewers for his foundations, but I don't want to set Mum off again. Together, we drag the pot across the patio to the opposite side of the garden. There. That's a good morning's work. I tuck my arm through Mum's, and she squeezes hard, locking me in place. Don't go. I have managed without crying, up to now, but my voice cracks, and I know it's a losing battle. I have to. Can we come and see you? Ella and me. If you won't come here, can we visit you? A moment of silence tells me the answer isn't one I want to hear. It wouldn't be safe.
I wouldn't tell a soul.
You'd slip up.
I wouldn't.
I pull my arm away, hot tears of frustration stinging my eyes. Mum looks at me and sighs.
If the police find out Tom and I are really alive, and that you knew it, that you concealed our crimes, harbored me, you'll be arrested. You could go to prison.
I don't care. Mum speaks slowly and quietly, her gaze locked on mine. Tom isn't going to let this lie, Anna. In his mind, I've double-crossed him, made a fool of him. He won't rest until he knows where I am, and it's you he'll use to find me. She waits, letting her words sink in. The tears come, falling silently down my cheeks, numb with cold. For as long as I know where Mum is, I'm at risk. Mark and Ella, too. I look back at the house, to where Ella has fallen asleep in her bouncy chair. I can't let her suffer. It's the only way. I make myself nod. It's the only way. But it's a hard way. For all of us.
Chapter 45. Murray.
Do you think she was involved from the start?
Nish scratched at a mark on the knee of her jeans. She was sitting at Murray's kitchen table, a mug of tea beside the pile of paperwork Murray had accumulated. Her statement says she was at a conference the night Tom went missing. Murray made quote marks in the air. The organizers confirm she was there for registration, but can't say if or when she left. So, her alibi's shaky. She didn't fake their deaths. Nish and Murray looked at Sarah, who, up until now, had been silent, listening to the two colleagues go over the case.
What makes you so certain? Nish asked.
Because she asked you to reopen the case. It doesn't make sense. Nish picked up her mug to drink, and then put it down again as a theory took shape.
Unless someone sent her the card to let her know they were onto her, and her husband saw it, so she brought it to us because that's what an innocent person would do.
He was at work. He didn't see it till later. Nish flapped a hand at Murray, as though the point were immaterial.
Or the postman, a neighbor. The point is, the police report was a double bluff.
Murray shook his head.
I don't buy it. It's a massive risk.
When did she tell you to back off? Sarah said.
Boxing Day.
Murray looked at Nish, who hadn't been privy to this piece of the puzzle. She hung up on me. Twice.
Then she found out sometime between the 21st and the 26th.
Sarah shrugged.
It's obvious.
Murray grinned.
Thanks, Columbo.
So, what now?
Nish said.
I need hard evidence. A phone purchase isn't enough, especially when, as it stands, Anna Johnson was miles away from Eastbourne at the time of the offence. I can't start claiming two dead people are alive, or storming down to Cleveland Avenue to arrest Anna, without proof the Johnsons are alive and well, and that she knew about it.
We need to think logically, Sarah said.
Why do people fake their own deaths?
Nish laughed.
Do a Reggie Perrin, you mean? You make it sound like it happens all the time.
There was the canoe man, Murray said. That was an insurance job. And that politician in the 70s. What was his name?
Stone something.
Stonehouse. Left his clothes on a beach in Miami and ran off with his mistress. Years of watching daytime quiz shows had made Sarah an expert in trivia.
Sex and money, then, Nish shrugged. Same as most crimes.
If only one of the Johnsons had disappeared, Murray might have placed more importance on the former. But as Caroline had followed in Tom's footsteps, it was unlikely that Tom had run off to be with a lover.
Tom Johnson was worth a lot of money, Murray reminded her.
So, Caroline stayed to claim the life assurance, then joined Tom in Monaco, Rio de Janeiro.
Nish looked between Murray and Sarah.
She claimed the life assurance all right, but she left Anna the lot. If she's living the high life somewhere, she's doing it on someone else's dime. Either they wanted to escape for some other reason, Sarah said, and Anna's reward was the money, or the three of them agreed to split the cash and she's just sitting tight till the dust has settled. Murray stood up. This was pointless. They were going around in circles. I think it's about time I paid Anna Johnson another visit. Don't you?
Chapter 46. Anna. We stand and survey the garden. The piles of leaves ready for the bonfire. The neatly fleeced bay tree. The lopped roses. It doesn't look much now, but you'll really see the benefits come spring.
I wish you were going to be here to see it. She puts an arm around me. Why don't you put the kettle on? I think we deserve a cuppa after all that.
I leave her standing in the garden, and it's only when I've kicked off my wellies and the door is closed and the kettle is whistling on the arga that I look out and see that she's crying. Her lips are moving. She's talking to her plants, saying goodbye to her garden. I'll look after it, I tell her silently. I let the tea brew and give Mum the solitude she so clearly needs. I wonder if she will go back up north, or if she'll find somewhere new to settle. I hope she has a garden again, one day. I fish out the tea bags, drop them into the sink, and pick up the mugs awkwardly in one hand, leaving the other free to open the door. I'm halfway across the kitchen when the doorbell rings. I stop, look through the glass doors at Mum, who shows no sign of having heard the door. I put the mugs down, slopping the contents onto the table. A dark stain seeps into the stripped pine. The doorbell rings again, longer this time, the caller's finger pressed hard against the buzzer. Rita barks, "Go away." "It's fine," I tell myself. "Whoever it is can't know anyone's home, and you can't see into the garden without walking down the side of the house." I keep an eye on Mum, to make sure she stays out of sight. She bends down and pulls out a weed from between two paving stones. The bell rings again, and then I hear footsteps, the crunch of gravel. Whoever it is, they're walking around the house. I run to the hall, tripping over in my haste to get there, and yank open the door. "Hello?" Louder. "Hello?" I'm about to run outside in my socks when the crunch of footsteps comes back towards me. A man appears from the side of the house. It's the police. My chest tightens, and I can't think what to do with my hands. I clasp them together, my thumbnail digging into the palm of the opposite hand, then pull them apart and thrust them into my pockets. I feel acutely aware of my face. I try to keep my expression neutral, but can't remember how that might look. Murray Mackenzie smiles. "Ah, you're home. I wasn't sure. I was in the garden." He takes in my mud-spattered jeans, the knee-length woolen socks that fit under my boots. "May I come in? It's not a good time. I won't stay long." Ella's about to go down for a nap. "Just a moment." Throughout our brief exchange, he has been walking towards me, and now he's on the bottom step, the middle, the top. "Thank you." It isn't that he forces his way into the house, more that I can't think of a way to refuse him. Blood sings in my ears, and the tightness in my chest makes my breath come fast and shallow. I feel like I'm drowning. Rita pushes past me and onto the drive, where she squats for a pee, then sniffs at the marks left by unseen cats. I call her. The lure of the cat is stronger, and selective deafness takes hold. "Rita, get here now!" "Through here?" Murray's on his way into the kitchen before I can stop him. There is no way he won't see Mum. The back wall of the kitchen is an almost unbroken sheet of glass. "Rita!" There are cars in the road. I can't leave her. "Rita!" Finally, she lifts her head and looks at me. And then, after a pause long enough to make it clear that the decision to come inside is hers, she trots back into the house.
I push the door hard, leaving it to slam on its own while I run after Murray Mackenzie. I hear a sharp sound. An exclamation. Not now. Not like this. I wonder if he will arrest her himself, or whether he will wait here for uniformed officers to arrive. I wonder if he'll let me say goodbye. If he'll take me, too.
Yeah, I've been busy.
I move to stand next to him. Our neat pile of leaves and prunings is the only evidence that anyone has been in the garden. A finch flies across the patio to the fence, where Mum has replenished the bird feeder. It hangs upside down, pecking at the ball of peanut butter and seeds. Aside from the birds, the garden is empty. Murray walks away from the window. He leans against the breakfast bar, and I keep my gaze steadily on him, not daring to glance again at the garden. This man is too perceptive. Too shrewd.
What was it you wanted to speak to me about?
I wondered how many mobile phones you had. The question takes me off guard.
Just the one?
I slip my iPhone out of my back pocket and hold it up in evidence.
No others?
No. I had a second one for work, but I handed that back when I went on maternity leave.
Do you remember what the brand was?
Nokia, I think.
What's all this about?
His smile is polite, but guarded. Just tying up some loose ends from the investigation into your parents' deaths. I go to the sink and start washing my hands, scrubbing at the dirt under my fingernails.
I told you I'd changed my mind. I don't think they were murdered. I told you to drop it.
Yet you were so adamant. The tap runs hotter, burning my fingers until I can hardly bear to hold them under the water.
I wasn't thinking straight.
I scrub harder.
I've just had a baby.
I add, using my daughter as an excuse to my mental list of things to feel guilty about. There's a noise from outside. Something falling over. A rake? A spade? The wheelbarrow? I turn around, leaving the tap running. Murray isn't looking outside. He's looking at me.
Is your partner at home?
He's at work. It's just me.
I wonder.
Murray breaks off. His face softens, losing the sharpness that makes me so uneasy.
I wonder if there's anything you want to talk about.
The pause stretches interminably. My voice is a whisper.
No. Nothing.
He gives a brief nod, and if I didn't know he was a police officer, I might have thought that he looked rather sorry for me. Just disappointed, perhaps, not to have found what he was looking for.
I'll be in touch.
I walk him to the door, standing with one hand on Rita's collar, while he crosses the road and gets into an immaculately polished Volvo. I watch him drive away. Rita pulls away, complaining, and I realize I'm shaking, holding her collar too tight for comfort. I drop to my knees and give her a fuss. Mum's waiting in the kitchen, her face ashen.
Who is that?
The police. Articulating it makes it even more frightening, even more real.
What did he want?
Her voice is as high-pitched as mine, her face as drawn.
He knows.
Chapter 47. Murray. Nish was still talking to Sarah when Murray returned home.
That didn't take long.
She wasn't exactly hospitable. Murray was trying to pinpoint exactly what had been wrong with the scene at Oakview. Anna had been jumpy, certainly, but there had been something else.
Did you ask her outright?
Murray shook his head. At this stage, we don't know whether she's only recently found out her parents are alive, or if she's known from the start. If she's guilty of conspiracy, she needs to be interviewed under caution by a warranted officer, not questioned in her kitchen by a has-been.
Nish stood up.
Much as I'd like to stay, Gil will be sending out a search party if I don't get back soon. We're supposed to be going out later. Let me know if you turn anything up, won't you? Murray walked her to the door, joining her outside as she found her car keys in the depths of her bag. Sarah seems to be doing well. You know what it's like. Two steps forward, one back. Sometimes the other way round, but yes, today's a good day. He watched Nish drive away, raising a hand as she turned the corner. Back inside, Sarah had spread out Caroline Johnson's bank statements. They had been examined at the time of Caroline's apparent suicide. A summary note on file concluding they held nothing of interest. There had been no large payments or transfers immediately prior to Caroline's apparent suicide. No activity abroad that might hint at a pre-planned hideaway. Sarah moved her finger down the rows of figures, and Murray settled on the sofa with Caroline's diary. He marked with post-it notes the period in the diary between Tom's disappearance and Caroline's. Did the pair meet up? Make arrangements? Murray scoured the pages for coded reminders, but found only appointments, lists of things to do, and scribbled reminders to buy milk or call solicitor. 100 quid's a lot to take out of a cash point, don't you think? Murray looked up. Sarah was running a neon pink highlighter across a statement. She lifted the pen, moved it a couple of inches lower, and carefully highlighted a second line. Not for some people. Every week, though. Interesting. Housekeeping money? It was a bit old-fashioned, but some people still budgeted that way, Murray supposed. Her spending's more erratic than that. Look, she uses her card all the time, Sainsbury's, Co-op, the petrol station, and takes out cash with no obvious pattern, 20 quid here, 30 quid there. But on top of that, every 7 days in August, she took out 100 quid. Murray's pulse quickened. It could be nothing. Then again, it could be something. What about the next month? Sarah found September's statement. There, too, among ad hoc cash withdrawals and card payments, were weekly withdrawals, this time for £150. How about October? £150 again. No, wait. It goes up halfway through the month. 200 quid. Sarah rifled through the papers in front of her. And now 300. From mid-November right up to the day before she disappeared. She dragged the nib of the highlighter across the last few lines and handed the sheaf of statements to Murray. She was paying someone. Or paying them off. Anna? Murray shook his head. He was thinking about the 999 calls that had been made from Oakview. The pocket notebook entry describing Caroline Johnson as emotional, following the report of a domestic from the next-door neighbour, Robert Drake. The Johnsons' marriage had been a tempestuous one, possibly even a violent one. Ever since Murray had realised the Johnsons had faked their deaths, he had been looking at Caroline as a suspect. But was she also a victim? I think Caroline was being blackmailed. By Tom, because she'd cashed in his life assurance. Murray didn't answer. He was still trying to work through the possibilities. If Tom had been blackmailing Caroline, and she had been paying up, that meant she'd been scared. Scared enough to fake her own death to get away? Murray picked up her diary. He had already been through it several times. But back then, he had been looking for leads on why Caroline had been at Beachy Head, not where she'd gone afterwards. He scoured the leaflets and scraps of paper tucked into the back, hoping he'd find a receipt, a train timetable, a scribbled note with an address. There was nothing. Where would you go if you wanted to disappear? Sarah thought. Somewhere I knew, but where no one knew me. Somewhere I felt safe. Maybe a place I knew from way back. Murray's mobile rang. Hi, Sean. What can I do for you? It's more what I can do for you. I have had the results back on a reverse IMEI search on that handset of yours. Which tells us what, exactly? Sean laughed. When you brought me the job, I checked the networks to see what handset that SIM card had been used in, right? Right. And you traced it back to Phones for All in Brighton. Okay. So the same thing can happen in reverse, it just takes a bit longer. I asked the networks to tell me if that handset has appeared on their systems at any point since the witness call from Beachy Head. He paused. And it has.
Murray felt a surge of excitement.
What is it?
Sarah mouthed, but he couldn't answer. He was listening to Sean.
The offender put a new pay-as-you-go SIM card in it, and it popped up on Vodafone back in the spring.
I don't suppose I know what calls were made?
Come on, Murray, you know me better than that. You got a pen?
Couple of mobiles and a landline that might just give you a location for your man.
Or woman, Murray thought.
He wrote down the numbers, trying not to be distracted by Sarah, who was flapping her arms at him, demanding to know what had got him so excited.
Thanks, Sean. I owe you one.
You owe me more than one, mate.
The call finished, and Murray grinned at Sarah, filling her in on what the high-tech crime officer had told him. He spun his notebook around until the list of phone numbers faced Sarah and marked an asterisk beside the only landline.
Do you want to do the honors?
Then it was Murray's turn to wait, while Sarah spoke to an inaudible voice on the other end of the phone. When she'd finished, he held up his hands.
Well?
Sarah put on a posh voice.
Our Ladies Preparatory?
A private school?
What did a prep school have to do with Tom and Caroline Johnson? Murray wondered if they were heading up a blind alley. The fake witness call, allegedly from Diane Brent Taylor, had been made last May, 10 months before the mobile had been used again with a different SIM card. It could have passed through any number of hands in the meantime.
Where's the school?
Derbyshire. Murray thought for a moment. He turned over the diary in his hands, remembering the photos that had fallen out from between the pages when Anna Johnson had handed it to him, a youthful Caroline, on holiday with an old school friend. Mum said they had the best time. They had been in a pub garden, a wagon and horses on the sign above them. About as far as you can get from the sea. He opened Safari on his phone and googled Wagon and Horses Pubs, UK.
Christ, there were pages of them.
He tried a different tack, looking up furthest point in UK from the sea. Coton in the Elms, Derbyshire. Murray had never heard of it, but a final Google search, Wagon and Horses Derbyshire, gave him what he wanted. Tarted up since the photo, and with a new sign and hanging baskets, but undeniably the same pub that Caroline and her friend had visited all those years ago. Luxury B&B. Best breakfast in the Peak District. Free Wi-Fi. Murray looked at Sarah. Fancy a holiday? Chapter 48. I grew up with sand in my socks and salt on my skin, and the knowledge that, when I was old enough to decide where I lived, it would be miles away from the ocean. It was one of the few things we had in common. I don't understand why people obsess over living near the sea, you said, when I told you where I was from. I'm a city dweller through and through. So was I. Escaped the first chance I had. I loved London. Busy, noisy, anonymous. Enough bars that being kicked out of one didn't matter. Enough jobs that losing one meant finding another the next day. Enough beds that sliding out of one never left me lonely. If I hadn't met you, I'd still be there. Maybe you would be, too. If it hadn't been for Anna, we wouldn't be together. We'd have parted ways after a few weeks, on to pastures new. Different arms, different bars. I remember the first morning at Oak View. You were still sleeping. Your hair messed up and your lips a fraction apart. I lay on my back and I fought the urge to leave, to tiptoe down the stairs with my shoes in my hand and get the hell out of there. Then I thought of our unborn child, of the stomach I'd once run my fingers over and now couldn't bear to even touch, taut as a drum, big as a beach ball, anchoring me to this bed, to this life, to you. 25 years of marriage.
It would be wrong to say I was unhappy for all that time. Equally wrong to suggest that I was happy. We coexisted, both trapped in a marriage that convention wouldn't let us leave. We should have been braver, more honest with each other. If one of us had left, we both would have had the lives we wanted. If one of us had left, no one would have blood on their hands. Chapter 49. Murray. What will you do if we find her? Sarah was navigating, the sat-nav on her phone sending them up the M40 past Oxford. She tapped the screen. Off at Junction 3. Arrest her? Murray said. Then remembered he wasn't a warranted officer anymore. He would have to call in reinforcements. Even though you think she was forced into it. That might mitigate the offences, but it doesn't negate them. She's still committed fraud, not to mention wasting police time. Do you think they're together? Your guess is as good as mine. Before they'd set off, Murray had called the Wagon and Horses and made inquiries about Tom and Caroline Johnson. Their descriptions hadn't rung any bells with the landlady, and so coming up themselves had felt like the only option. Would he have done the same, had he still been a detective? He might have wanted to. A jolly on the DCI's budget was always a perk. But there would have been more efficient ways of finding out if the Johnsons were in Coton in the Elms. He would have put in a request to Derbyshire Constabulary, asked officers to make inquiries, checked their intelligence systems, all of which was possible when you were a warranted officer, and none of which could be easily achieved by a retired DC, who had already had his knuckles wrapped by the superintendent. It's nice to get away, Sarah said. She was gazing out of the window as though she was seeing rolling hills or ocean views, not a motorway service station on the approach to Birmingham. She grinned at Murray, like Thelma and Louise, but with less hair. Murray rubbed a hand over his head. Are you saying I'm going bald? Not at all. You're just follicularly challenged. You need to stay in the left-hand lane here. Maybe we should do this more often. Track down dead people who aren't really dead. Murray grinned. Take road trips. Sarah was scared of flying, and in the 40 years they had been together, they had only been abroad once, to France, where Sarah had had a panic attack on the ferry, hemmed in by cars waiting for their turn to drive off. There are so many beautiful places to see in this country. I'd like that. Another reason to retire properly, Murray thought. If he was at home all the time, they could take off whenever they wanted to, whenever Sarah felt up to it. Maybe they could buy a motorhome, so she never had to worry about other people. Just the two of them, parked up in a pretty campsite somewhere. He would see this job through. He'd never yet given up on a case, and he wasn't going to start now. And then he would hand in his notice. He was ready to go now, and for the first time in a long while, he looked to the future without misgivings. Coton in the Elms was a pretty village a few miles south of Burton-upon-Trent. According to the pile of pamphlets in their room, a nicely finished double on the first floor of the Wagon and Horses, there was plenty to do within a short drive, but little in the village itself. Murray couldn't imagine it had been the most scintillating of destinations for two young women, although he supposed if you lived in inner-city London, the contrast of fresh air and beautiful countryside was a holiday in itself. In the photograph, Caroline and Alicia had looked as though they hadn't had a care in the world. In the recently refurbished bar, the landlady was putting up decorations for the following night's New Year's Eve party.
It was lucky that you wanted one night. We're packed out tomorrow. Pass us that blue tack, will you, Duck?
Sarah obliged. Are there many places to rent in the village?
Holiday cottages, you mean?
Something more permanent, really. Flats, perhaps? Cash in hand, no questions asked, that sort of thing. The landlady looked over her glasses at Sarah. She narrowed her eyes.
It's not for us, Murray grinned.
He'd worked with a few detectives whose questioning skills lacked refinement, but Sarah beat them hands down.
Oh, no, it's not for us. We're looking for some people. The couple you mentioned on the phone?
Murray nodded.
It's possible they're in the area. If they are, they'd want to stay out of the spotlight.
The landlady gave a snort of laughter that wobbled her ladder.
In Coton, everyone knows everyone's business here. If your pair were here, I'd know about it.
She took another piece of blue tack from Sarah and stuck a bunch of silver balloons onto a fake beam.
Speak to Shifty tonight. He might be able to help.
Who?
Simon Shiftworth. Shifty suits him better, though. You'll see why. People who can't get a council flat get one of Shifty's. He'll be in around 9. Always is.
Sarah looked at Murray. It's a date. They ate in the village's other pub, the Black Horse, in order to ask the landlord if he knew of any incomers to the village. He didn't. Murray was surprised to discover he wasn't overly bothered by their lack of progress. In fact, if the entire trip proved to be fruitless, he didn't care. Sarah was looking happier than he'd seen her in months. She had polished off steak and chips and a treacle tart, along with 2 glasses of wine, and the pair of them had laughed in a way Murray didn't think they'd laughed since they first got together. A change was as good as a rest, they said, and Murray could feel his own spirits lifting, as surely as if he'd spent a week in a health spa.
If Shifty's not here, we can just go to bed, Sarah said, as they walked back to the wagon and horses.
It's still early, I'm not...
Murray caught Sarah's wink.
Oh, good plan.
He hoped Shifty would decide to have a quiet one at home, but as they headed to the bar to get a nightcap to take upstairs, the landlady jerked her head towards the snug.
In there, you can't miss him.
Murray and Sarah exchanged a glance.
We'll have to see him. But...
It had been a very long time since Murray had had an early night. Sarah suppressed a laugh at his obvious frustration.
We've come all this way.
They had. And with any luck, their chat with Shifty wouldn't take long. Plenty of time for an early night. The landlady had been right. There was no missing Shifty. In his 60s, he had greasy yellowed hair pasted across a bald head and thick-rimmed glasses so smeared it was a wonder he could see through them. A cold sore wept in the corner of his mouth. He wore pale blue jeans, black trainers with white socks, and a leather jacket, cracked at the creases of each elbow.
He looks like a public service announcement for paedophiles, whispered Sarah.
Murray shot her a look, but Shifty showed no sign of having heard. He looked up as they approached.
Kaz says you're looking for someone.
Two people, Tom and Caroline Johnson.
Never heard of them,
Shifty said, too fast for it to mean anything either way. He looked Murray up and down.
Not police, are you?
No,
Murray said, with a clear conscience. Shifty drained his pint glass and set it down deliberately in front of him. Murray knew the score. Can I get you a drink?
I thought you'd never ask. I'll have a pint of Black Hole.
Murray caught the landlady's eye.
A pint of Black...
And a whiskey chaser,
Shifty added.
Right.
And a couple lined up for later. I'm feeling thirsty.
I tell you what,
Murray opened his wallet.
Why don't I give you this?
He pulled out 2 £20 notes and laid them on the bar. From his pocket, he took out photographs of Tom and Caroline Johnson, given to the police after each was reported missing. And you can tell me if you rented a flat to this couple. Shifty pocketed the cash.
Why do you want to know?
Because they're pretending to be dead.
If Shifty had half the nous he appeared to have, he'd tell them nothing and get on the phone to the Daily Mail.
They owe us money, Sarah said.
Inspired? Murray wanted to applaud. Shifty was nodding, no doubt reflecting on his own experiences of absent debtors.
Never seen this bloke,
he jabbed at the photograph of Tom Johnson.
But the bird?
He jabbed at Caroline.
She's in one of my bedsits in Swad. Different hair, but definitely her. Goes by the name Angela Grange.
Murray could have kissed him. He knew it. Fake suicides. This was huge. He wanted to spin Sarah around, buy champagne, tell the whole pub what they'd discovered.
Great, he said. At least she was.
So close.
She scarpered, owing me a month's rent.
Take it out of her deposit, Sarah suggested helpfully. Murray tried to keep a straight face and failed. Shifty looked at her as though she had suggested he wash his hair.
What deposit? People rent from me because there are no deposits, no contracts, no questions.
No carpets, Kaz contributed from behind the bar.
Fuck off,
Shifty said mildly. Could we take a look around the bedsit? Nothing ventured, Murray thought. A regular landlord would tell him where to go. Shifty, on the other hand.
No skin off mine. Meet you there tomorrow morning.
He looked at the full pint and the tumbler of whiskey in front of him.
Better make it after lunch.
The address Shifty had written down for them was in Swadlincote, 5 miles from Coton-in-the-Elms, and with none of the latter village's charm. An array of charity shops and boarded-up premises graced the town's high street, and a motley collection of youths outside Summerfield suggested employment opportunities were limited. Murray and Sarah found Potter's Road and parked outside the block of flats Shifty had described. The building was red brick. Several windows had been covered with metal grills, which had in turn been covered with graffiti. A large yellow penis was sprayed across the front door.
Nice place, Sarah said. We should move here. Lovely outlook, Murray agreed.
A cairn of mattresses filled the scrubby garden at the front of the property. In the center, a charred circle showed where someone had tried to set fire to them. Sarah nodded towards an oncoming car, the only one in the deserted street. Do you think that's him? There was nothing low-key about Shifty's car. A white Lexus with lowered suspension and out-of-proportion wheels. Blue LEDs glowed from behind a silver mesh grille, and a giant spoiler weighed down the rear end.
Classy.
Murray got out.
Maybe you should wait in the car.
Not a chance. Sarah hopped out and waited for Shifty to emerge from behind the tinted windows of the Lexus. The man was a walking cliché. Murray was surprised he hadn't seen a gold medallion glinting between his shirt buttons. No time was wasted on good mornings. Shifty gave them a curt nod and strode past towards the penis-adorned entrance. The bedsit where Angela Grange, a.k.a. Caroline Johnson, had spent the last 12 months was depressing. It was clean, cleaner, Murray suspected, than when Caroline had moved in, judging by the filth in the communal stairwell. But the paint was peeling from the walls, and with all the windows shut fast, condensation glistened on every wall. Murray nodded at the extra bolts on the inside of the front door.
Standard around here, are they? She did that. Someone had the frighteners on her.
Did she say that?
She didn't have to. She was jumpy as fuck. None of my business.
Shifty was wandering around the room, checking for damage. He pulled open a drawer and picked up a black bra, turning to Murray with a leer.
36C, if you're asking.
Murray wasn't. But if Shifty was going to poke around, so was he. Someone had the frighteners on her. Tom. It had to be. And if Caroline had skipped town, did that mean he'd found this flat? Murray was finding it hard to keep up. This investigation had morphed from a double suicide, to a possible double murder, to a fake suicide, and now... what? Was Caroline still on the run? Or had Tom caught up with her? Was Murray now looking for an abduction? It would be the perfect crime. After all, who's going to look for a dead woman? There wasn't much in the flat. Some clothes, a tin of soup in the cupboard, milk in the fridge Murray wouldn't risk opening. The bin stank of rotting food.
but Murray took the lid off regardless. A clutch of blue bottles flew into his face. He picked up a wooden spoon from the draining board and poked around in the rubbish. His mind was working overtime. What if Caroline hadn't faked her own death for financial reasons, but because she was scared? Tom had been blackmailing her, asking for more and more money, until Caroline felt the only avenue open to her was to disappear. After all, it had worked for her husband. Murray's attention was caught by a sheaf of paperwork buried beneath a pile of used tea bags. Something about the layout, the logo, was familiar, and when he pulled it out, he knew exactly what it was. The question was, why did Caroline have it? As he read through the document, pieces of the puzzle began to drop into place. He didn't have the whole answer, not yet, but everything was beginning to make sense. Fake suicides were driven by money, yes, sex, too. But there was another reason why people wanted to disappear, and it looked as though Murray had just found it. Chapter 50 Anna. Mum is packing. She doesn't have much. The small bag she took with her to the Hope and a few bits I persuaded her to take from her own wardrobe at Oakview. I sit on her bed, wanting to beg her to stay, but knowing it's pointless to try. She won't stay. She can't stay. The police will be back, and next time, they won't let me off so lightly. It's going to be hard enough convincing them I know nothing about my parents' crimes, without worrying about whether Mum is well hidden enough. "Won't you at least stay for the party?" Mark said, when she announced at breakfast she would leave today. "See you in the new year with us." "I'm not really one for parties," she said easily. She loves parties. At least, the old Mum loved parties. I'm not sure about this one. My mother has changed, and I don't just mean the weight loss and the dyed hair. She's anxious, subdued, constantly watchful. She's been broken, and now my grief is twofold. I am mourning not only a mother, but the woman she used to be. I make one final attempt to keep her. If we told the police everything, Anna, no. They might understand why you did what you did. And they might not. I fall silent. I'll go to prison. You might, too. You'll tell them you've only known since Christmas Eve that I'm alive, but do you think they'll believe that? When it looks as though Tom and I planned this together, when the house is in your name now. That's my problem. And when you're arrested, it'll be Mark's and Ella's. Do you want that little girl growing up without a mother? I don't, of course I don't. But I don't want to be without one either. Mum zips up her bag. There. Done. She tries for a smile that convinces neither of us. I reach for her bag, but she shakes her head. I can manage. In fact, she breaks off. What is it? You'll think me ridiculous. Try me. Could I say goodbye to the house? Just a few minutes. I pull her to me, hugging her so tightly I feel the very bones of her. Of course you can. It's your house, Mum. Gently, she breaks away, smiles sadly. It's your house, yours, Mark's, and Ella's, and I want you to fill it with happy memories. Do you understand? I nod, blinking hard. Mark and I will take Ella around the park, give you a bit of time to say your goodbyes. I don't think her ridiculous at all. A home is far more than just a house, far more than bricks and mortar. It's why I wouldn't countenance Mark's suggestion that we sell up, why I didn't want to challenge Robert's grand designs extension. This is where I live. I'm happy here. I don't want anything to change that. In the park, Mark pushes Ella's pram, and I tuck my hand into the crook of his arm.
You haven't had a call from the police, have you?
I look at him sharply. What do you mean? Why would I have had a call from the police?
Mark laughs. Relax. I don't think the FBI have caught up with you just yet. The guy from CID said he'd ring today to let us know if they'd managed to get any DNA from the rubber band. I've had nothing on my mobile, and I thought they might have tried the house phone.
Oh, no. Nothing. The pram's wheels leave puddle tracks on the path. Actually, I've been thinking about that, and I think we should drop it.
Drop it?
Mark stops short, and I walk into the pram handle.
Anna, we can't drop it. It's serious.
The note said no police. If we drop it, they'll stop.
You don't know that.
I do. I take my arm from Mark's and begin walking again, pushing the pram away from him. He runs to catch up.
Please, Mark, I just want to forget about it. Start the new year off on a positive note.
Mark is a big believer in fresh starts, new chapters, clean pages. Perhaps all counselors are.
For the record, I think it's the wrong thing to do.
I want to move on from what happened to my parents for Ella's sake. I look down at her, as much to hide my face as to reinforce my point, feeling guilty for using her as emotional collateral. He nods.
I'll tell them we're dropping it.
Thank you. My relief, at least, is genuine. I stop again, this time to kiss him.
You're crying.
I wipe my eyes.
It's all a bit much, I think. Christmas, New Year, the police.
Mum. I get as close to the truth as I dare.
I'm really going to miss Angela.
Did you spend much time together when you were younger? You never talk about her. I didn't realize you knew her that well. The lump in my throat hardens, and my chin wobbles as I try my hardest to stop myself from sobbing.
That's the thing about family, I manage. Even if you've never met before, you feel as though you've always been together.
Mark puts one arm around me, and we walk slowly back to Oak View, where twinkly lights around the porch mark the start of New Year's Eve, and the beginning of the end of this terrible, wonderful, extraordinary year. Mum's in the garden. I slide open the glass door and she jumps, panic on her face until she sees that it's me. She's not wearing a coat, and her lips are tinged with blue.
You'll catch your death, I say, with a wry smile she doesn't return.
I was saying goodbye to the roses. I'll look after them, I promise.
And make sure you put in an objection to...
Mum. She stops, mid-sentence. Her shoulders sag.
It's time to go.
Inside, Mark's opened a bottle of champagne. An early New Year. We clink glasses and I fight back tears. Mum holds Ella, and they look so alike I try to fix the moment in my memory, but it hurts so much. If this is what it's like to lose someone slowly, I would pray for a sudden death every time. A sharp break to my heart, instead of the slow splintering I feel right now in my chest, like cracks crazing across a frozen lake. Mark makes a speech about family and reconnecting, about New Year's and new starts. This last with a wink in my direction. I try to catch Mum's eye, but she's listening intently. I hope the year brings health, wealth, and happiness to us all. He raises his glass. A very happy New Year to you, Angela, to my beautiful Ella, and to Anna, who I am hopeful might this year say yes. I smile fiercely. He will ask me tonight, at midnight perhaps, when my mother is on a train to heaven knows where, and I'm grieving on my own. He will ask me, and I will say yes. And then I smell something, an acrid burning, like melting plastic, teasing my nostrils and catching the back of my throat.
Is there something in the oven? Mark is a second behind, but quick to catch up. He moves swiftly to the door and into the hall.
Jesus!
Mum and I follow, the smell in